Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And minute 77 is beginning, and we're just picking ourselves up off the floor from all the explodey kaboom boom stuff. So Hal, catch us up on minute 77.
Thank you for introducing that technical term to my lexicon, explodey kaboom boom. All right. I need a moment. Okay, here we go with minute 77. In the London lab, Howard Stark, dazed from the explosion, rises groggily. Write that down, he mutters to his assistant, who's still sprawled on the floor. At the Strategic Scientific Reserve offices, Steve Rogers strides in. A blonde private, Lorraine, sits reading a Stars and Stripes newspaper, its headline blaring, 400 prisoners liberated. Steve clears his throat. Excuse me, I'm looking for Mr. Stark. Lorraine, engrossed, doesn't look up. He's in with Colonel Phillips. She glances up, her eyes widening as she recognizes Captain America. Of course, you're welcome to wait. With no chairs available, Steve leans against the desk. Lorraine smiles, her tone warm. I read about what you did. Oh, Steve shifts, sheepish. Yeah, well, that's, you know, just doing what needed to be done. Sounded like more than that, Lorraine says, wiggling her ankle playfully. You saved nearly 400 men. Steve shrugs. Really, it's not a big deal. She stands, sauntering toward him. Tell that to their wives. Steve crosses his arms, uneasy. I don't think they were all married. Lorraine steps closer. Too close. You're a hero. Well, that depends on the definition, really, Steve stammers. She grabs his tie, her voice sultry. The women of America. And we'll find out on our next episode just what she thinks about the women of America and what they might owe.
Oh, Lorraine.
Oh, Lorraine.
Steve has so little game. He's just, exactly. He's so hapless and hopeless.
He hasn't even taken the wrapper off the game box. It's just, it's oh boy, oh boy.
He gets more practice later being truly humble, but he's not even very good at being humble yet, you know.
Right, it's just a bit sort of stilted and awkward, and we'll talk more about this further downstream, but I think, you know, this little sort of diversion and this Lorraine character and, you know, having some desires and some angles on him, you know, I get it. It's a nice touch. It's character building and stuff. But as soon as she comes near him, I'm just saying, just go find Peggy. Just walk away. Okay. I don't want to see this play out. I don't want some misunderstanding or worse.
I was thinking the exact opposite. I was thinking, go for it, kid. But you know, that's why I'm not Captain America.
Gosh, I do like, it's funny. There's a little Joe Johnstonism here where he always uses a newspaper to tie the scenes together. It's like, remember that time back there, 400 prisoners, it's like, there's a flying man.
Right.
It's the same concept. He just loves that little detail, which I guess, he can't not do period pieces because nobody's going to whip open a newspaper, maybe scrolling through their phone.
Right.
Did you see this?
Yeah. It's a neat shorthand. And it's the first time we've ever actually gotten a body count or a head count for that rescue of Steve's. It's a neat thing. Does Joe Johnston actually do that on every movie? Is it a Hitchcock signature of his?
He did it on October Sky. He did it on The Rocketeer.
Rocketeer, yeah.
And now here, I can't remember if he did it in Jumanji or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I don't think there were any newspapers in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Can't recall in Hidalgo or...
Hidalgo might have had some. I think there might
have
been
some. Family disappears in backyard. Yeah. Last scene getting small.
Exactly. Yeah. Jurassic Park 3.
It's a neat device. You know,
now the dinosaurs can fly.
Yeah. You know, they fly now?
There's your head lie. Yes, they
fly. It's a neat device. I like it. And thanks for pointing it out.
It's a terrific device because it fills in a little bit more, you know, as you said, it gives us a count. It helps us understand the scope and the scale of it. It tells us within a little bit of reason how much time has passed. So we know this is, it's recent, but this is not the same day. The size of the type is telling us this is how important this was. And this is the recognition that he's getting. It communicates a lot with just a simple, you know, quote unquote, simple prop.
It also does, like all actors love a bit of business that you know, they can do something if they're typing or sewing or, you know, but even reading a paper helps. It just gives her some, and it also, it's a lead in for why she's going to suddenly realize, hey, I've got a hero sitting right here at my desk or not sitting on my desk.
Natalie Dormer does a great double take there.
She does.
Oh, she does. Yeah. Yeah. Can you guys make out the entire subhead? We've got 400 prisoners liberated and then Miracle Trek across enemy lines. There it is. I was scrubbing a little bit. So
yes. Deep into Lorem Ipsum.
yes, exactly. Beyond that, it's going to be a bit deeper. But although I don't know, I mean, knowing Joe, I'd be surprised if the memo on the typewriter behind her isn't full of.
Yeah.
And every box or binder on the shelves back there, probably full of relevant and valid information if there was some way to zoom in.
Yep. He loves that attention to detail. I think we can add Natalie Dormer to our long, long list of English actors in this movie who have to affect an American accent.
True.
It's just a ton of them.
Right.
Yeah. Including many we've talked to on this podcast already.
Yeah, and she may be one of the most successful momentary players in this thing. I mean, she had that long run on Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And she does a great job being in the 40s. It's costume and hair and makeup, but that hair is straight 1943. The way, you know, I don't know how many hours with a curling iron they got. It's probably a wig.
It's probably a wig. Yeah.
Yeah.
But she's done. She kind of specializes in period pieces. I mean, she did Game of Thrones. She was Anne Boleyn. She was in the Hunger Games. That's not period, but it's not current day.
Hunger Games has a very specific and I think you could argue retro inspired style that she fits right in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she does have that almost the way she stands up. The only way I could describe it is predatory. It's like watching a cobra get ready because she's about to strike.
Jim, your mention of her fitting in the 40s, I think is very apt because she's sort of a 40s version of a sexy woman, like a Veronica Lake or something. She's a va-va-voom kind of gal, you know, which wouldn't fly in, you know, 60s, 70s, 90s. I mean, she would be an attractive woman in any era, but the particular, I don't know, her manner, the way she's dressed, the way she acts, the way she moves, that's very 40s appropriate.
Yeah. She could easily be Rita Hayworth, a blonde Rita Hayworth in this thing. It's intense.
And making that drab uniform, although it's obviously, you know, tailored for her, but, you know, something that has very masculine roots, but she makes it extraordinarily feminine, I would say. And that's about as far as I want to go on that topic.
Yeah, good.
And, you know, we've got to have her just to have Peggy something to react to.
Right.
Exactly. Well, and they're an interesting contrast, too. I mean, Lorraine's a blonde and Peggy's a brunette. And, Peggy's no nonsense. And I would say Lorraine is a lot of nonsense. I mean, what you see with Peggy is what you get. And what you see with Lorraine is layers, man. And nothing but artifice, I'd say. Like, she has no interest in Steve until she realizes who he is. And then all of a sudden, you know, the dog gets its scent.
Something I have to point out here, it's a physical feature of Natalie. There's nothing wrong with it at all, but she has something that is known in medical industry as hypertelorism. The distance between her eyes
from the center of her nose is much further apart than most people. Another actress who has played on this a lot is Anya Taylor-Joy. Anya Taylor-Joy. I may be.
Oh, you're right. It is Taylor-Joy. I'm sorry.
Anya Taylor-Joy.
I'm looking at the wrong link. Anya Taylor-Joy. Yes, the Queen's
Gambit.
You got
to get your eyes a little farther apart, Brian.
Yeah. I crossed them. I got the words mixed up. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the opposite of Beatty, I think. You know, it's definitely getting your money's worth at a 3D movie. But it is very, it's very alluring seeing someone staring at you like that.
Yeah. That was an affectation, characteristic, let me say, that Ian Fleming used a lot in the Bond books. There was a lot of, it was fairly common. I couldn't give you a list of characters, but in describing someone, you know, usually a female character, she had clear gray eyes set wide apart.
Interesting.
See that phrasing in there quite a bit. And then the villains always had a grotesquerie to them. Hugo Drax in Moonraker's teeth were splayed out from his mouth because he, you know, sucked his thumb until he was 16 or something like this. There's always some sort of slightly icky little thing. But yeah, for the women, there was often their eyes were set wide apart.
Sounds a little like a Dick Tracy approach, you know, his villains were just always these grotesqueries of flat top and I don't know, smush face, and I don't know what they were called, but
prune face was one.
Prune face.
And he was also in Return of the Jedi, prune face, according to Kenner, who made the action figures. So,
In researching, getting ready for this minute, I found an interview with Natalie Dormer in which she was asked what she thought happened to Lorraine after the movie, and she said, "Quote, I'm sure she found an even keel and became a very responsible, hardworking member of society." So that's what the actor thinks of this character.
Oh, okay. Well,
she found an even keel.
Well,
as opposed to a Steven Rogers, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the name of the guy she eventually married. Even keel.
Yeah, he pronounces it Evan, but that just doesn't sound right.
I was hoping that she'd team up with Gilmore Hodge and just have just some League of Villainry.
They'd be perfect together. But Steve would be. Steve's stuttering. He's just charming in this. And it tells you, despite the fact that he's become a superhero and he's, you know, anything anybody would ever want to be physically, he's still just the same kid. And I think it's a neat character bit, just his stammering and stuttering, the way he crosses his arms when she gets close to him. And as you said in your notes, Jim, your intro, or as Hal said aloud, a little too close.
Yeah, I was trying to describe it, and that's the only. It's like this is where he'd start backing up, which he does a little bit. He leans back, but he doesn't actually step it back. He's like, okay,
but he's still Steve Rogers. He's got the physical confidence now. He knows what he can do physically, but he doesn't have the emotional maturity, the emotional confidence to be to handle this woman.
Yeah. Well, he's never experienced it before, having someone, you know, who was worried about getting, you know, stepping on him while he's dancing, and suddenly there's this big hulking guy. And
remember too what what he saw last night before retiring was Peggy in the red dress.
Yeah.
That's gonna linger and, you know, make him second guess, you know, any other potential sort of dalliances, I would think.
Yeah, and it's just something. I mean, I guess celebrity is something that sudden celebrity is something people have to deal with. He's had to deal with it, well, about four or five times, I guess. You know, once in Brooklyn, and then always out there on, you know, Radio City and things like that. When he was going to Buffalo and Chicago and stuff, and people were, you know, these blondes again were coming up and asking for his autograph. It's like, how do you react to it? It's like, well, sure, I'll sign it. Why do you want my autograph? And he's just never quite gotten the hint. He never went to celebrity school.
Yeah. So, and maybe this may be Joe Johnston's little commentary on that issue of here's a kid who's all of a sudden a hero, a genuine hero, not a pretend, chorus girl hero. And how it can turn your head, how it can put you off balance, you know?
Yeah, catching up with, and you know, I mean, Joe, although, I mean, Joe has such a background in Star Wars. He's known throughout the Star Wars universe as the guy, the guy that made Yoda, the guy that is, designed the X-Wing and things like
The
that. He put
Death
the, you know,
Star, the
the
Millennium
Death,
Falcon,
yeah,
Boba
all
Fett.
that. And it's like that was for him, it was 50 years ago. And it's like he's done a lot of things in since
Right.
then. And there's other stuff in his life. He's got family, he's got hobbies, he's got travels.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, I why don't we talk about the Death Star again?
Right.
But which is, it's like I'm really happy that Joe managed to be on our show, but I can imagine that the last thing he wants to do is relive old times of really arduous, I mean, imagine trying to put this movie together after all the other ones that he's done. It must have been quite a workout, all the moving parts. So yeah,
Yeah, apparently there is nothing like a Marvel movie. I mean, even people who've been making movies for 20, 30 years just walk into a Marvel and just say that was a whole nother level of movie making.
Well, I have a question for both of you guys. Both of you guys have experienced celebrity in one form or another. Brian, when somebody comes, when somebody comes up to you at a Comic Con and stuff like that, and they want your autograph, they're asking you questions about things, you're like, yeah, how do you? I mean, I know you're probably grateful. Thanks for buying the book, but what, when you're experiencing a crowd of people and you're in the middle of it, does it ever throw you?
Well, we could have a whole conversation about this, which I guess is the point of a
Yeah.
podcast. I would say, first of all, don't overstate or overthink the level of celebrity I've achieved, but I have had that. I've been to book signings and I've been to places where a lot of people want my time and attention. You learn to deal with it. And what's interesting to me is I didn't become a professional cartoonist until I was in my 40s. So, my personality was kind of baked in already. I was set. I was a done person by that point. But enough happened to me that I could see if I were in my early 20s, it could have really screwed me up. It could have messed with my head, and it didn't, because I was older and I know all things will pass, and sic transit gloria. But I mean, you just. I'm always appreciative. I'm always as gracious as I can be. I always give everybody as much time as I can. And one thing, this is getting a little bit deeper than maybe intended, but I wrote two books about serious nonfiction things, Mom's Cancer and A Fire Story. And what I learned is when you write a book like that, people want to tell you their stories. They've got a cancer story, or they've got a fire story, or a disaster, natural disaster story. And very early on, I thought I had an obligation to say the right thing to help make them feel better, to make their life better. I thought I had to somehow therapize this interaction we were having. And it took me a little while to realize I couldn't do that, and they don't want that for me. What they want is they want someone to listen to them who understands what they've been through. And I can do that. I'm a good listener, and I know the questions to ask, and we can have a nice interaction of me just letting them tell their stories, because so few people will let them just tell their story, and I can do that for people. And so that's kind of where I've settled in, particularly with those two projects. But I'm always happy if I show up, if anybody else turns up. And I tell you, I've had nobody turn up, so I've been humbled a lot, and I expect nothing, and roll with whatever happens.
You gotta tell a bookstore owner, yeah, people like my book, really.
That's really no, that's
Well, they're the ones I feel worse for. So I come to a
Yeah.
book signing and they've got a stack of books on the counter and they sell like three of them. It's like, Jesus, I'm so sorry, you guys, man. I wish I were Stephen King so you could have sold some books. But and bookstore owners, they've seen it all, they've done it all, they don't care. But they're the ones I feel bad for. I never feel bad for myself. I feel a responsibility to draw a crowd and put on a good show for the people who are hosting me.
Yeah. And
Yeah, that's
Hal,
really. Oh.
you oh, I'm sorry, Hal, you've got like a quarter million of your best friends showing up next month. And I mean,
Actually,
you
three quarters of a million
three,
with a
okay.
little bit of luck.
Yes. But I mean, you in terms of like time slicing, you don't have any, I mean, hi, nice to see you. Goodbye. And off you go on the golf cart, as I can imagine, is.
Yeah, and it's working the big event like that, and I don't think anybody has ever before, and nor will they subsequently ever use the word celebrity in describing me, but you know, in my small world of aviation, I'm, you know, I have some name recognition. I mean, I see my byline in a magazine and on a couple of books and things like that. And through things like podcasts, like honestly, in the aviation world, Jim, I'm recognized at least half as often for the Rocketeer podcast as I am for the work podcast, the aviation specific podcast. But so I will just say that I'm sometimes in that situation of, and then being on stage every night during this big event, I'm in that situation where sometimes more people know me than maybe I know them. And if that counts as some sort of little tiny flavor of celebrity, I'll shake my head and I guess begrudgingly take it. But
I have seen on Facebook people go to your events and enthuse because they had a HAL sighting.
That does come up. And certainly a lot of those people are my friends. And certainly there's a sense of, I think sometimes it's a bit, it's ironic, but that could just be humility talking. But I don't know. For me, it's just a matter of you know, that initial feeling of, oh my gosh, they know me. I must know them. Maybe I don't remember their name or something like that. Then they'll explain, you know, X, Y, or Z, who they are or what they saw or read or whatever else like that. And it's, I mean, it's always wonderful just to run into somebody who appreciates your work, no matter what it is. I read this story in the magazine. I really, really liked it. You know, for me, like high school and college for me was mostly about, or largely about theater and a lot about music and things. And when you're performing that kind of performance, you know, you stop and you get applause and the transaction's complete.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, yeah, I know they appreciate it. I got my feedback. That's great. And that's very gratifying. A lot of times writing, Brian, as you would know, you know, better than anybody, you know, obviously you don't send it to the publisher and listen for applause. Mm. You know, things come around. But, you know, when you were talking, Brian, about people wanting to tell you a story, I mean, I thought more about my, you know, my position of interacting with celebrities as opposed to any kind of notoriety I have myself. But, and I even thought about the first time I contacted you as the godfather of this whole series of enterprises here that brought this all together. But I mean, I contacted you because I'd read, you know, Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow and just fell deeply in love with it. And I'm sure this didn't, you know, really come across or anything else, but that would be an example of when I want to establish a little bit of credibility with you by saying, you know, this is what I love about World's Fairs. And these are these things. I want to tell you enough of my story so that I think you will understand how much my praise for your work it means to me, the value of it. You know, I don't want to just go in and say, oh yeah, I read your book. I like that one drawing. That's cool. Whatever. It was, I liked it. And here's why I think I'm one of the people who got it. And some of that it's frankly, it could be a little bit egotistical, a little bit narcissistic on my part to try to say, you know, I don't know if everybody gets your work, Brian, but I'm smart enough.
You're verbally wiggling your ankle at him.
Right. Yes, I'm verbally wiggling my ankle at you,
Brian. And that's why we're still friends today, Hal. <It's because> You get me.
I continue to fool you.
I've had that experience from the other side, approaching you know, a much more successful cartoonist or writer or someone whose work I admire. And my feeling is I only got one shot to make this impression. You know, I'm probably not going to see this person again.
Right.
So I'm going to vomit out whatever I think they need to know about me to know that, you know, I get them, you know, that here's why I appreciate your work. Exactly what you just said about you talking to me is I've done that to other people. And, you know, generally they're appreciative. We have a nice conversation and occasionally an ongoing relationship. And sometimes they just look at you like you have horns growing out of your head. Like, I did not need this while I was walking to the bathroom.
Right, exactly. No, I'm not shaking your hand. Yeah.
Excuse me. My soup is getting cold. You
know? Yeah.
But, yeah. And I suppose when I think about people that I've run into that, you know, read something I wrote or, you know, seen or heard my voice in something, I've never stopped to think about it until this episode, but I can certainly see when people have done that to me. And it's just, I'm not in that mindset of saying, wow, I'm something special. Look at this person work to ingratiate themselves. It's just, to me, it's just a conversation.
Yeah. What I think Hal and I are both saying is that we understand exactly how Steve's feeling in this, and the groupies are the hard part.
They really are.
Yeah.
And it's always the wrong number. I mean, sometimes it's too many. And then sometimes like for half a century, there's zero. I don't know if you've ever run into that.
I've the last half century, that number has been zero. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really steady yeah. at zero.
At least it's consistent.
Again, well, there is that.
I always appreciate feedback. I mean, the feedback that we get on this show is very good. And we've had, and in previous podcasts, we've had, you know, all kinds of different things, people pointing out mistakes we've made. And, you know, positive, constructive criticism is always appreciated. And I never know how to react when I get, like, there'll be a FedEx box in the mail and somebody will have sent me Rocketeer gear that they've been collecting. And it's like, maybe they're trying to empty their garage. But, you know, yeah. I was like, why are you making this Christmas for me right now? I don't understand that it was really that, you know. Did we really talk that good? So
isn't that neat? I've had that happen. People just give me astonishingly amazing things that they've worked hard on themselves, handcrafted or whatever. Yeah. It's like, I don't know you. I can't pay you for this. There's nothing I can do to it. It's a very unsettling, unequal relationship, but a very cool thing. And you just have to say thanks and take it with some grace, I think. But yeah. Sometimes it's just, wow. Yeah.
There's no like celebrity school. One of the people that I think is a great mentor on this is Billy Campbell from The Rocketeer. Cause I've in the time that Hal and I were doing The Rocketeer Minute, we had a very good relationship with Billy, and people were asking if they could send him things like that their kids had watched The Rocketeer and had drawn The Rocketeer, and he would like get the picture and then take a picture of him with the drawing that some, you know, 6-year-old made. And it's like, that's the best reaction, just getting this affirmation yeah. from your hero saying, gee, thanks, I appreciate the work that you've put into this. So it's just, you know, if you can be like Billy is the only thing.
He likes Billy.
What would Billy do?
Yeah. Well,
Billy's working at a whole nother level.
Yeah, yeah. We just got to star in our own feature film and see how that turns out. But anyway, this has been a fascinating discussion, and we really would love to continue the discussion. We love hearing from people. We're, you know, it's like you can make us celebrities if you feel like talking to us. That's fine. But we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. And if you do like our show, and you know, one of the nicest ways to respond to us, if you could subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
Do this all day.